Welcome back to another episode of Mention Your Dispatches. I quit counting numbers. This is the episode with Mo. Welcome, Mo. How you doing, Mo?
Doing good. How you doing?
Doing all right. So we got Mo back from Mo's game table. And because we can't have just Mo here, we've also grabbed Ian, our good buddy, Rocky Mountain Navy. How you doing, Rocky?
Hey, good evening, everyone. How are you?
I hope everybody's doing fine that's listening to us. We've got these distinguished gentlemen on the line with us tonight because we're gonna have a chat about some particular kinds of war games. We're going to talk a little bit of amphibious warfare tonight, not warfare with both hands. We are not Charles Shackelford. We're going to talk about, those nautical landings and fighting while getting your boots wet instead of just dirty. But before we do that, I'm curious, Mo, what was the last game you had come in the door as of the day we are recording this?
Granada, Last Stand of the Moors, 1482 to 1492 from Compass Game.
And what's your first impression of it? Just cracking it open and taking a look.
It's a beautiful game. It really is. It did a great job on it. And it's derivative of the Sekigahara system. So I think fans of that will definitely want to check it out. And it's also wider scope than Sekigahara because now you got naval as well as ground, and you got much more freedom of movement across the point-to-point movement map than you did with Seki, because that was just, that's the way that battle was. It was kind of linear with just a couple of pathways into the castle. But here you've got a lot more room to move. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun to play.
So the game it is derivative of is which one?
Sekigahara.
Yeah, I'm just impressed that you can pronounce it correctly, because Lord knows I would have screwed that up. So
studied hard.
have you played with Granada at all in like a pre-press copy or on Vassal or anything, or is this your first time getting your hands on it?
No, it's my first time getting my hands on it, and just real impressed with the quality of it. And the one thing that people might will notice right away is that the blocks are not those big chunky blocks that came with Sekigahara. And some people may not like that. I actually do like it because it makes stacking a lot easier, because one of the things I always thought was a little funny about Sekigahara was, those stacks can get pretty high, so because they're really chunky blocks, but they're beautiful. And Compass did the same job with these. Men are real beautiful.
Yeah, it starts to look like a Jenga game.
Yeah.
Be careful. So, excellent. Ian, what was the last thing you had come in the door?
So I'm going to swear to all of you right now, this was not pre-planned. We didn't set this up as an ambush, but the last game that came through my door yesterday was Sekigahara. I was able to pick it up from a local seller. I played once. He said his wife said, thank you, but no more. So he sold it off, and it is now sitting on my table here. So those beautiful blocks are already all stickered up. The rule book is barely cracked, so I can I'll be able to jump in and start playing that one soon, very soon.
Nice. Outstanding. So the last thing that showed up here at Casa Guillory was Bear Flag Republic. Ordered it from the guys over at Quarterdeck. It's about the California independence movement in the early 1800s. And for folks that don't know, Quarterdeck is having a big sale right now. Jack's trying to move out a lot of older inventory and play catch up from some of the lost sales from lost conventions and such. Anybody, as we are recording this, the Siege of Vicksburg convention is still in our future, and Jack will be there with a whole lot of Quarterdeck's inventory. But for folks that are looking for some deals on some oddball, off the wall, hard to find, hard to get kinds of games, take a look at the Quarterdeck International site. Jack's got some good sales going on. But I just had Bear Flag Republic come in the door, and just within the last like hour and a half, because I just got back from saying goodbye to a friend of mine who's literally leaving the country. And so the mail was waiting for us when we got home. So I'm looking forward to digging into Bear Flag Republic. It's a point-to-point thing. It's kind of a multifaceted political with a lot of military action. But it's also multi-faction, because you've got a couple of different California factions, the Mexican, the nascent Mexican government, a lot of Native American factions. So I'm looking forward to playing around with this one. With that, let's talk a little amphibious warfare here. So Mo was in the Marines. Ian has done a whole lot of different naval intel work. Look, I drove tanks around and blew stuff up. I don't like getting my feet wet. That's one of the reasons I like being 10 feet up on a tank and with a really good heater on it to dry my feet out when they get wet. So this is not my area of expertise, which is why I dragged these guys in here. But
on a tank too, and we just did a lot of fording ops to get up on the beach. So definitely used to getting wet.
Yeah. But But again, there's that whole, you know, ethos of every Marine is a rifleman. You just happen to have different jobs. And so at some point you get your boots wet. But one of the things that I always thought was really cool about amphibious warfare and the war games around amphibious warfare. And this is an area where the Marines certainly outpace every other service we have, is when you start talking combined arms, like in the Army, that means you got your tanks, your grunts, your artillery, your aviation and stuff. When the Marines talk about combined arms, they got boats, they got dudes running around on the ground, and they got aircraft overhead. They bringing it all. Like, you guys don't own your own submarines, I'm pretty sure. But other than that, you've got everything else as a part of the operation. And so when we start talking about combined arms warfare, amphibious ops are like the ultimate archetype of that because of how many different things you bring to the table. And so with that as a starting point, Mo, what are a couple of war games that you've enjoyed over the years that you think model amphibious ops well, or at least do a good job of making an enjoyable game out of them?
I think the first one that comes to mind is D-Day at Tarawa, because it shows the difficulty of that invasion, especially being that they were not able to get all the Marines ashore on a landing craft. They had to wade ashore, and how dangerous it is to have to wade through all that water for hundreds of meters while getting shot at. You know, and a lot of guys lost their lives before they even hit the beach. And it just goes to show the importance of getting good hydrographic readings ahead of times to get that intel and know your high tide and low tide and everything else, which is what the problem was for those guys. And that was real interesting. And getting your guys to the shore, you really feel it's a grind. The D-Day at games, you feel are a grind to begin with. But then you add in the naval aspect of it, the amphibious aspect, and it really does drive home that point. That's the best one I can think of off the top of my head. I don't have any others right now, but that would be the first one I would definitely say would get that point across real well.
As just a quick note for the audience, that's one of the solo games, right?
Yes.
D-Day ATS. Those are all solo
games. Yeah, John Butterfield's game. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay. Just, I was pretty sure, but I wanted to confirm and make sure we weren't leaving our audience ill-informed on this. So I
didn't. And then, you know, another amphibious one, obviously along the same line, would be D-Day at Omaha Beach, you know, because it does the same thing just with the Army instead of the Marine Corps.
Yep. When we were planning this, I will give Mo full credit for this. When we were planning this call, you know, there was some conversation going back and forth by email, and I pointed out that the Army had the largest amphibious operations of World War II, and Mo's reply was,
"Well, it takes more Army guys than it does Marines to make an amphibious landing, a successful amphibious landing." That was all in jest, because when it comes to all this, in the end, actually, the Army had more amphibious landings than the Marines did in World War II.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have a much bigger presence, obviously. And the invasion of Normandy was a much different beast than any of the island hopping campaigns the Marines did, because the simple fact they were landing an invasion force and they were trying to get across all of Europe or to Germany. And the Marines were taking small islands so that way they can have that, you know, those aircraft refueling stations and those airfields for the aircraft to be able to make the move towards the mainland of Japan. So it was a different thing altogether, but either way, it's just a hellish way of attacking assaulting an enemy is through amphibious thing. And another thing to mention, like you said about the Marines, it's not just the Marines, it's the combined Navy Marine Corps team that makes it happen, because the Navy brings us there, then they kick us out and say, go ahead, go raise hell. And we do. But they're also overhead with their aircraft. They're also assisting with naval gunfire. It's a real good cohesive team effort between the Navy and the Marine Corps to make amphibious operations successful.
Yeah. We'll circle back around to it later.
Sure.
Bringing up some World War II discussions, but the Army had a significant presence in the Pacific as well, where the Marines essentially shot, you know, east to west across the Pacific with the islands that they were hopping, basically kind of from Hawaii, draw a line from Hawaii to Okinawa. And that was sort of the axis that the Marines came on. The U.S. Army had a significant island hopping campaign of their own that went south to north, coming out of Australia, working their way up kind of perpendicular to where the Marines were going, oversimplifying massively here for the podcast and all. But they, you know, the Marines had a lot of island hopping. The Army didn't hop to as many smaller islands, hit some bigger ones, but then had, you know, some extended campaigns on those islands that where the Marines were hopping from island to island. The Army would hop to a bigger one, have to fight there for a little while, then go hit the next one. So probably fewer landings overall, although somebody will likely correct me on that. And same kind of question, what are some war games you've seen or ones that you've played and enjoyed that you think do a good job of portraying amphibious operations as a part of the different war games?
Well, the first one I'm going to mention probably is not the greatest, you know, if you're looking for a realistic war game, it's probably not the greatest example, but it's one that has been in my collection for a long time. And it's one of those go-to fun ones because it's so thematic. And that's Beachhead, which is an old Yaquinto album game from back in the 80s. I mean, it is literally a John Wayne movie put into a war game form. You even got Sergeant Rock as one of your counters and such. But it captures the elements, the essence. You have the Marines coming ashore on a landing craft, and the way they set the map, there's the long way to approach to which to lesser defended beaches, or the short way to approach to better defended beaches. And then you get ashore, and it's World War II, so you got the Japanese with their mortars and machine gun lanes and trying to set up the terrain. You gotta, as U.S. Marines, you gotta get ashore, get sufficient forces ashore, and move inland and capture an objective. Incredibly simple, not a very complicated game. But it captures the elements of it. And then back then, especially as a young war gamer and playing a lot of different games, it gave that certain sense of this was different. It's not just coming across the ridge and trying to push your way across the objective. You got that whole amphibious piece. You got to get the boats to shore. The mortars are raining down. You have offshore naval gunfire support. You have aircraft that can come in and add to your attack. It was a good simplification, but a good capturing of the essence of all the pieces of amphibious warfare. And it's still fun to pull out because it doesn't take a long time to play, and it's got the right little thematic moments in it.
You know, this is bringing to mind one of the articles you'd written for the site, in that something doesn't need to be overly complex to do a good job of presenting some of the key principles to you. And I'm thinking back to your Hunt for Red October game and the model that you had explained in there of the different layers of the naval combat, where you had to kind of think ahead of time of sort of how those layers are put together in your naval battle groups. Sure, I don't have the doctrinal terminology exact there, but despite being a relatively simple game, just having to think about how you arrayed those assets for the naval battles sort of implicitly taught you some of those key principles of battle group warfare for the Navy. And it sounds like, you know, the amphibious game did a very similar thing without necessarily having to do some bullet by bullet level physics engine or anything.
Exactly. And that's what makes the Yaquinto album games was a very interesting packaging concept. They took a double fold LP album. I know there's probably a lot of people out there going like, what language is he talking? The counter storage was horrible, but where you would normally slide the records in, that's where the rules or the charts went, and you folded it open and you had your map. It was for you know, the junior high school kids, it was the ultimate. You could just throw it in a bag and take it with you and plop it down on a table and go. But it's still as simple as it was, and as simple as the presentation and the components were, it actually did a very good job of getting you the sense of that whole amphibious invasion. You never had enough Marines. You had always had the pillboxes and the mortars, the machine gun lanes, they had the fire lanes for the machine guns. You had to get across barbed wires. You needed your engineers. As the Marines, you need to work it all together. You need to land and get your guys ashore. You need to get some of your heavy weapons, support weapons ashore to give you some extra firepower. You need the engineers to blow through some of the obstacles. If you got a tank there, it was awesome, but getting tanks ashore were difficult because, you know, the Japanese are going to try to take those out first. And you had some air power too that could roll in. And it captured all the right elements of it and gave you that big taste of putting it all together. And of course, like I said, there was Sergeant Rock in there, so you always had your little hero that could try to save you at the end. And it, like any of those games of the days, yes, the Japanese had their bonsai charge you always had to watch out for. That would come, it could come and just ruin your day. But it's thematically, it captured all the elements, and that's really what you need in one of these amphibious games, is something that captures all the elements thematically. It doesn't have to be super detailed, though there are some super detailed ones out
there. Yeah, I mean, Mo's going to argue that you always have exactly as many Marines as you need.
Well, I mean, the thing with the amphibious invasions, it's a really tough thing to depict because, like you were saying, do you want to go really deep into the nuts and bolts of it, or do you just want to get a good abstraction that gives you the right level of challenge so you can feel, so you can get the feel of how much of a grind it is to establish the beachhead? And one of the biggest things, like Liberty Roads does it, I believe, where you, and I think a few others do too. I know D-Day and Beyond has it as well, where they've got alternate landing, you know, sites where you can land. You know, you can go the historical landing sites, or you can go and select others, and that opens up all different challenges to you. And yeah, it's ahistoric because it's following a different pathway, but it allows you to explore the different ways of, you know, establishing that beachhead and then moving inland from there, what challenges that poses. You know, it's not just establishing the beachhead, but then being able to move your men and material onto the shore and then make a good push in to get to those victory locations. And it just shows you that it's a real big logistic problem, as well as just the, you know, the fighting aside, the logistical problem itself is also a whole nother thing to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. Ian, one of these days we're going to have to do an entire episode just on Yaquinto games.
Because games were awesome.
As we move beyond sort of these were kind of fun ones, looking at some slightly deeper ones, you know, Mo, you had talked about how a lot of amphibious warfare is, you know, the naval portion of this is an important coordinating piece of getting the Marines on the beach, or in the case of the Army, getting whoever on the beach, like we're using Army and Marines just because we're a bunch of Americans talking about wargaming. But the same principle applies for the Brits and the Falklands. The same principle applies for, you know, whoever's having to do a landing somewhere. Let's hope the same principle doesn't apply for the Chinese heading into Taiwan, but who knows what the future will hold. As a part of all of this, trying to build that level of coordination into the real world is a pain in the ass. We've tried it. I think all three of us have tried it at various levels in our you know, limited military careers there. But trying to build that coordination in a war game is a whole separate layer of headaches. And so with that thought, you know, Mo, what if anything have you seen for games that explicitly try to make sure that they're modeling all of those different facets of amphibious warfare and where they may have succeeded or failed?
That's a tough one. I've not seen one in my experience so far that really captures that to that detail. Because one of the biggest problems with amphibious assaults is the rehearsal, the timing, everything. You've got to have your, like I was saying before, your reconnaissance of the landing beaches, and then you have to time your naval gunfire support to end at the time that you reach a certain point with your landing craft. And then when you get to the landing craft, you have to move your naval gunfire up further up the beach, things like that. Then of course, once you get on the ground, then you have your artillery and you have your aircraft and everything else. All these things have to work on different hacks, so that way you can move successfully onto the shore and then establish the beachhead. That's not even taking into account the defense that you're going to be up against. So it's tough, I think, to model all those in a war game. And to the best of my knowledge, I've not experienced that level of detail yet.
Ian, what about you? Have you seen any? Have you had any experience with any that did it well or did it crappy?
Well, I won't pass a judgment on whether it's well or crappy, but the Admiralty Trilogy games, Harpoon, Command at Sea, both of them have, for the Command at Sea, the World War II version, and then Harpoon or the Falklands modules has amphibious landings modeled within it. It's not as detailed as what Mo was just talking about, but it does get you for your naval shipping. You have to decide where's your amphibious assembly areas, where are you staging your ships, where are you staging your escorts, where's the gun line, where over the horizon is the air power coming from. The games even let you set up your lanes coming in to for the beaches and such. So it gives you a taste of that logistics and the planning side that comes in. And of course, that's because games like Harpoon and Command at Sea are in many ways more simulation than they are game. If you wanted a taste of that, those are the only ones. And those are somewhere in the super tactical level, quite frankly. The Falklands South Atlantic War modules tried to sort of take it up a little bit of a level, a little bit operationally. There was some World War II scenarios back, or pardon me, World War III scenarios in a old GDW module for Harpoon 3 that tried to take it up a little bit of a higher level. But one is the tactical pieces. That's the only war game that I know of that I've experienced that gets you down into that level of detail, which, as Bo will tell you, I mean, doing it, the planning is the hard part, and that makes it in some ways not a good candidate for gaming, because people want a game. They don't want to sit there and plan and be that, you know, just be the J5 or the G5 there, you know, planning all that stuff. We're working with the ops guys trying to put it all together. No, you just want to play. Just let me go out and execute it. So if you're going to do it, you're probably going to kick the scale up to something more like a D-Day at Tarawa, or even something, some of the other big, just the D-Day games where you have a division coming ashore, that counter coming ashore on the beach, and you just simulate it from there.
Although that would make for an interesting game from a planning standpoint, if you could come up with a plan and then just basically let the game run itself, as far as seeing how, like, abstract the landings out. Obviously, like, you're going to roll based on all these different modifiers on the different things you put in place and see how well your plan worked. That would be interesting, I think, to do something like that. But how much of a repeat game that would it be? I don't think it would be hugely replayable unless you're into that simulation aspect.
I think one of the challenges, and you both sort of danced around this a little bit without necessarily explicitly mentioning it, is you're going to run into a bit of a scaling issue at a certain point, especially once you get into World War II and beyond, where you also involve the aircraft. But part of the scaling issue you're going to run into is if your ground counters are broken down at a certain point where you're dealing with anything at company or below, where each counter is a company or smaller, then the scale of hexes that you need in order for those guys to occupy a realistic and doctrinally accurate or historically accurate and reasonable amount of real estate going ashore, then your naval counters that you're providing in support, whether they're naval gunfire or the staging areas from which the ground units disembark, and quite frankly, you're going to want those present in the game because you would want them to be able to be targeted by the defenders ashore. The scale is going to be such that you've now got ships that are taking up 3, 4, 5 hexes on the map, as opposed to those platoon and company level counters that are taking up, you know, 1 hex floating around on the map. It's, you're not really ever going to get ground units taking up more than 1 hex, but just the amount of scale, the space that these different forces take up on the map itself. If you're running platoon level counters around out there for an amphibious assault, you're probably talking, what, 100, 150, 200 meter hexes at the most.
Yeah.
And so a 200 meter hex, I mean, that's a medium sized boat, but you know, if you've got an aircraft carrier offshore, I mean, that's like what, 4 hexes long at that point.
Well, yeah. I mean, most amphibious games that we play are going to generally be at the tactical level, company, maybe battalion down to company, because you need to, like you said, you need to keep it smaller so you can control it. And then it becomes more of a tactical game, which it's going to be. And you're going to abstract out your naval gunfire support at that point. You're going to have them, they're going to be off board. The only thing you're going to have on board would be your landing craft. And, you know, depending on how they've got the defense of the island modeled, they may or may not take hits and take casualties and things like that. But like CSS, the system that Adam did, he's got the Guam and I think Tinian and all those. And then what's the other one? The South Pacific, what is it? South Pacific series that Chris does, Pacific Islands campaign. So those ones. I just did an unboxing of Pacific Islands campaign Iwo Jima. And those are at that same tactical level, you know, where you're just going in and you're dealing with your troops landing on the shore. You're not dealing with the naval gunfire aspect other than as a modifier.
Yeah. And that gets back to what are we trying to do and how are we trying to scale it? Because if we're going to give the defenders a fighting chance, they ought to be able to target those boats offshore to either try and preempt some of the disembarking units or disrupt some of that naval gunfire support. And again, this gets back to scaling. In order to have those things on the map where they are targetable, Now you've got a significant amount of blue hexes on the edge of the map for how far those bigger ships are offshore and using the landing craft to ferry the guys, you know, ashore. But you're also going to run into a scaling issue on the aircraft. And that is if you've got the map so tight down there that you've got platoons and even company level ground forces, you know, again, one counter is a company, then your aircraft are moving so fast across the map that they're on the map for like a turn, maybe two at the most. And then they're out of space on the map to occupy. They got to loop back around. And again, that significantly changes things for guys on the ground being able to target your aircraft. And at a certain point, if what you're wanting to play the amphibious game for is to be able to see how well you can synchronize and orchestrate all of these different assets, to be so down in the weeds that a bunch of those assets have to get abstracted off the board already, are you really getting what you're playing for? And I think that might be a little challenging. Ian, what do you think?
Well, I think it all comes down to what are you really focusing on? And I think part of what the Admiralty Trilogy group sort of shows with the amphibious pieces is that it's really complicated. It takes a lot of planning and it's not a lot of fun. So maybe purists will play it, but for the most part, you're going to go to a game like D-Day, a D-Day game that's going to abstract all those pieces out. And if you're going to get down that tactical, there's going to be even more abstraction. I mean, even like Jim Day's Panzer series from GMT has aircraft in it. But what you do is just they attack. You put it there. You put your counter down. It attacks and it leaves. I mean, it's a fancy form of off-board artillery. But the interesting piece that I see about amphibious pieces, since I come to it from more of the, you know, Moe's very much the boots on the ground sort of guy, I come from it more from a Navy piece. So when I look at amphibious operations, I sometimes take the abstraction the other way. Instead of extracting out the ships and the aircraft, I change my focus to that and I abstract the ground side of it. So, and that changes your perspective amphibious. So many times amphibious operations then become not the battle, but getting the forces to the right place. So, you know, the classic fleet games, or even the newer South China Sea from Compass, getting your Marines to the island to occupy them, fighting your way through, and then you abstract out the whole ground battle. That comes down to just a die roll with some defensive modifiers and maybe some offensive modifiers. That gets abstracted out, but then you focus. You take the abstraction, you take the scale the other way, and now you have the 45-mile hexes, and you have aircraft from several hundred miles away that can affect, and ships that are trying to sail into harm's way and escort the amphibs in to get to where they can deliver the forces ashore. Over the horizon to the shore. So it's a matter of what do you want in your amphibious games? Do you want that boots on the ground perspective? It's going to be very small probably, or do you abstract it high the other way and then focus on the ships and the aircraft?
Yeah, I think I'm probably more in Moe's camp than yours. Just again, that's kind of my background is, you know, driving tanks around, blowing stuff up, as opposed to the wider angle lens that you're probably approaching things with. The part of the challenge there, of course, you know, like you said, what is it you're interested in? And that will help determine some of the scaling. I don't know that there's necessarily a right answer for what's the sweet spot in between. And I think that's part of what makes things a little tougher about figuring out how to tackle amphibious warfare. I remember some years ago, guys, probably 10, 15 years ago now, one of us could probably look it up if we weren't so busy talking to each other on the podcast. But Against the Odds magazine had a War in the Aegean game from a while ago. It's World War II. And it's one of those sort of Brits coming out of Egypt, headed towards Greece, trying to distract and tie up the Germans. Oh, by the way, the Turks aren't real fond of you sailing too close to their theoretically neutral waters. And it was an amphibious game that operated at the low operational, high tactical level, because that was the size units running around out there. But it spanned a pretty significant chunk of real estate across the eastern end of the Med that really made you have to think about how much you could actually move your assets around, given how limited they were. And I remember thinking, this is a great concept, and had some fun with the concept and reading it all and really wanting to push the stuff around. But then once you started pushing counters around, it kind of left me feeling flat, because it was too low level for the big picture stuff you were talking about there, Ian, but it was a little too high level and you didn't quite have enough assets to really get the oomph of the fun of the actually herding guys ashore and trying to get close air support on the right target. It was just sort of kind of in that very vanilla space in between. And it was unfortunate because I thought it had a really cool setup for that. But it just left me a little flat and I was a little bummed by that. But I,
against the odds, issue 14, Warren Eugene.
Like I said, somebody was going to be able to. And again, you know, to their credit, you know, against the odds went, you know, way off the reservation with this. Is like, you know, who's really spent much time studying the Aegean campaign in World War II. This is something that is definitely cut from a different cloth, and that's cool. Like, let's definitely keep doing things like that. It never all quite blended well enough for me to really enjoy it as a game. Your mileage may vary.
Well, you know, one of the things that we've talked about this. Go ahead.
No, go.
Oh, I was going to say we've talked about this before, and I've talked with several people. I think everyone's talked about this when it comes to naval landings like this, specifically the Pacific Islands in World War II, which is the last great big example of a theater wide amphibious operation, you know, level of amphibious operation. When you model the Pacific at the highly abstract level, you're just basically moving ships around and you're taking islands. If you, and then if it's like, oh yeah, we just took the island. Okay, let's move on to the next one. If you are going to show the actual island assault, it really comes down to you have to go at the tactical level for it to feel, you know, like it's, you're really getting anything out of it. And then when you do, it is a very one-sided game. That's why Pacific Island games make for great solitaire games. You just throw out the Japanese defenders, you turn them over, you don't know what they are, and then you just play the assaulting force, and that's it. Because it's very static for the defense. They literally stayed in place for the most part. That's the way it was historically. And it was just, it was a meat grinder. And that's what you do get out of those games. But it's not always as much a fun experience if you're going to play at a post.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably something more along the... Maybe Empire of the Sun is a little too high scale for what you're describing. Maybe come down a step or two at most. But I think that's probably the area you're operating in, right? You've got division size counters floating around on the map out there.
Yeah.
So, Ian, you were about to jump in there with something about War in the Aegean.
No, I think the War in the Aegean sounded like it was they were trying to do island hopping in the Mediterranean to show you that it wasn't just a Pacific thing. But I will give them credit too for trying to pull together all those pieces and making you think that of your island hopping campaign, not as an individual, one individual island, but at least a campaign of, hey, I'm going to go here, then go here, then jump over to this one, bypass that one, which is elements of the island hopping campaign, not necessarily amphibious landings that don't always come across in those tactical games. I mean, places like Tarawa were chosen for a reason, and then the intel was screwed up and things were made really bad. Getting yourself out, that's a very tactical look at what's going on there, and trying to extract yourself from that quagmire has to best be shown to you at the tactical level.
I think one of the things that when we're talking amphibious warfare, one of the things we all immediately jump to is World War II, because those are the big classic examples that we've got the movies for these things, right? We've seen The Longest Day. We've seen what was the Clint Eastwood Iwo Jima one? Flags of Our Fathers?
Yes. Yeah. And Letters from Iwo Jima.
Yeah. So we've seen these movies. Those are the games that we immediately jump into play in. Saving Private Ryan, you know, the first 30 minutes of Saving Private Ryan, that there's a very clear visualization of what's going on there. Backing up pre-World War II, amphibious operations, like what's out there, and what, if any, games can we sort of brainstorm on thinking of some of these things for any sort of kind of amphibious ops out there? And I'm honestly a little stuck. There's probably some stuff from the Mexican-American War. I don't know that Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders really count because they started ashore. They didn't really wade their way ashore. What's out there for pre-World War II amphibious stuff? Any ideas? Rocky, what do you got?
Gallipoli. But you have to remember, I'm sure Mo's quite familiar, is that between World War I and World War II, the whole concept of what an amphibious operation is changed. Prior to World War II, amphibious operations were in many ways not opposed landing. They were, I mean, yes, there was Gallipoli. But for the most part, if you go back even pre-World War I, an amphibious operation was just delivering troops to across or from the water to the shoreline. And many times it was not done in an opposed manner. There was some river crossing pieces that I guess you could call amphibious. But for the most part, it was a totally different definition of what amphibious warfare was as compared to what we saw and grew up in World War II.
Yeah. No, it's very true. You know, there was not that widespread amphibious assaults like there were in World War II. Prior to that, there were amphibious like Gallipoli, like you said, and there were others. I just can't think of all of them off the top of my head. But and we've even in ancient times, they had amphibious assaults, you know, when they would bring in troops off the triremes and things like that. But it was mostly, as you said, unopposed. It was getting a landing force on there to go inland and fight, not necessarily to be fighting an opposed landing, because the technology wasn't there at the time for fighting to attack the beach as well as defend the beach. So you basically just let the guy get on the beach if he could, and then fight from there. You may get close to the beach to make their landing a little lot more difficult, but it wasn't like it was in World War II. You know, plus you're also talking different. One of the biggest differences in World War II, in the Pacific specifically, was the fact that you had these tiny islands. These guys were fighting over islands that were a mile, 2 miles, 3 miles long. They were tiny islands, hundreds of meters across. World War II, when you get to the European theater and you go to D-Day, they had that entire Atlantic coast that they had to worry about. The Germans had to worry about. They had to do the best guess as to where the Allies were going to land. And they did not have everything in place that they wanted to for D-Day to oppose that landing, but they had that giant killing ground, that huge beach that they had to get across. And it was really well lined with, you know, machine guns and everything. So it was difficult in that aspect, but it was terrible in that aspect. But again, it's something that really did come into its own mostly in World War II.
Just trying to think back through history, some things other than Gallipoli that might have been something opposed on the beaches. And honestly, you guys are right. These things are unopposed landings, and I'm not thinking of anything off the top of my head. The Brits came ashore pretty well unopposed in their approach to New Orleans in 1814. That fight was out in the swamp outside of New Orleans. So it's not like the Brits were coming off the boat as a part of that attack. You know, just thinking about other actions in the 18th, 19th century, you know, Pensacola, I think everybody was pretty much on the ground when Pensacola broke out. I'm not sure there were any British amphibious invasions in the American War of Independence. I'm pretty sure there weren't in the Civil War either, but just the American War of Independence. I'm not thinking of, look, the colonials certainly weren't doing any sort of amphibious assaults. We didn't have enough Navy to do it. Yeah. Just trying to think of when the Brits might have, I don't recall any.
As Armchair Dragoons continue the seventh season of Mentioned in Dispatches, we need to take a moment to thank those Patreon supporters who pledged at the regimental patron level. So a special thank you to Patrick Mullen, Hethwill Wargames, Steelgrave, Mike Quigley, Staggerwing, Robert, Joseph Knoll, Treb Curry, Kevin Bertram, and Patrick Garrity for their support of Armchair Dragoons and helping us bring you the best wargaming content on the web. You can join our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
Well, think about this. The last time there was any type of amphibious assault was Incheon.
Yeah.
So that's a long way from here, you know, back to the 1950s. So that's 70 years. And the Marine Corps, their whole thing is amphibious, but they've gotten away from that. And they're getting into these landlocked battles that they've been involved in, you know, Vietnam and Grenada, and then you had Iraq and Afghanistan, all that stuff. They're trying to get back to that now with the Marine Littoral Regiments, but still, that's going to be littoral defense, not necessarily amphibious assault.
Yeah, well, so just thinking back, how opposed, if at all, were the landings in the Falklands that the Brits did in 82?
That, I don't know off the top of my head. I'd have to actually, honestly, I'd have to look that up as to how opposed they were. I know they were opposed, but not sure.
There was... There was limited opposition where they came ashore. So it was, they put some teams across first. Some were Hilo, I think, the smaller Hilos, and they put some like special boat service, special SAS stuff ashore. The immediate beach defenders were very small, pushed them aside. got the force ashore and established right away. Interesting that you mentioned the Falklands, because I came across a it's in the public access portion of DTIC, the Defense Technical Information Center, and it was a study that the Army did in 1983, because they realized that their model that they had for the Army system, whatever Army, their war game model that they were using, had no amphibious module in it. And they commissioned Captain Hughes, who was wrote the book on fleet tactics and stuff, and he was working for, I think, Center for Naval Analysis at the time. They commissioned him to come in and develop the module for the Army to do an amphibious assault, how to model it. Because even they, at the professional level, had ignored it. And they had to go take the lessons of the Falklands and try to draw something out of that to validate, you know, build and validate their models for professional wargaming and planning development.
Yeah. You know, again, I'm just sort of trying to mull over different places where we might have. And I'll tell you, look, the official record will say that there was an amphibious assault in Somalia in, what, 92, 93. There were more television cameras on the beach than there were opposition forces. So, yeah, they came ashore on a boat to what, thunderous applause? Like there was no real opposition to that landing at all. So I don't think we can count that one. It's the same reason the 82nd got to drop into Baidoa, right? We didn't let the Marines amphibiously assault the Kuwaiti beaches. We didn't let the 82nd Airborne jump into Kuwait in 1991. So we're going to let them jump into Baidoa out in Somalia, when instead we could have just flown them into the airport, thrown them on some trucks and driven them out there. You know, why not? Let's let them jump. So,
yeah,
you know, this whole thing about opposed versus unopposed out on the beaches makes you wonder just how much dramatic license the screenwriters for the movie Troy took when Brad Pitt's assaulting the beach outside the walls of Troy, coming ashore there. Because they sure make that, you know, try to become Saving Private Ryan with swords and sandals, don't they?
Are you saying that Hollywood embellishes? Come on, man.
Yeah, you know, I didn't want to explicitly come out and say it, but, you know, you went there, so I guess we'll just admit it. But it is kind of a cool scene. Cinematically, it's fun to watch. Mm-hmm. You know, the Trojans, the Greeks storming the Trojan beach, you know, it's a fun way to watch the assault there. An entertaining way to do sort of, like I said, the ancient version of Saving Private Ryan. Not sure how realistic it was, but what the heck? It was entertaining as a movie. Are there, you know, again, just trying to go back pre-World War One, you know, we mentioned Gallipoli, post-World War II, we've mentioned both Incheon and the Falklands. What else is there?
Well, I would say one other one to look at would be next war Taiwan, because if there's an assault on Taiwan, there's only going to be one way it's going to be. I mean, you can come in through, you know, via air, you can drop guys in, but you're going to have to assault the beach. Yeah. So that's another one where amphibious operations will definitely be in.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm just looking at sort of amphibious assault operations. There was a Persian invasion of Greece. I guess there was some wading ashore near Marathon, maybe. There was the Spanish amphibious assault on Terceira Island in 1583. Sure. Japanese invasions of Korea in the late 1500s. Ian, that's more your part of the world than mine.
So a lot of those historical ones, when they call them amphibious invasions, what they really are saying is that the armies were delivered over the shoreline, but it is not necessarily, and in many cases wasn't, an opposed landing like you get in World War II. Indeed, going back, going further back, or back pre-World War One, a lot of your amphibious landings actually many times were preceded by some naval engagements with coastal forts. Because many times you wanted to bring them ashore. Oh, I want to go where the docks already are, and I can get my boats, that's deep enough water, I can get my boats in, because they didn't have dedicated amphibious landing craft. So many times an early amphibious invasion was actually would be preceded by a naval battle against coastal forts, and then you just simply after you've cleared out the forts, or you pushed them back, or you know, or you've been pushed back and then you don't go. But if you defeat the forts and get past it, now you land your, you take your soldiers ashore. I mean, World War, or probably the American War of Independence, a lot of that was let's get past the forts and drive up to the docks at Alexandria and offload the troops, or something like that. And it was not an opposed landing, but it was still amphibious because you were bringing your army not over land, but over water.
Yeah. So sort of flanking by naval maneuver almost, because look, this was all pre-flight. So it's not like you could do a vertical envelopment. So you're attempting to turn the enemy's flank by using sea movement. There was one that, you know, look, happened right down the road from me in the, In the American Civil War, there was the Battle of Fort Fisher, which Fort Fisher's on the south side of the Cape Fear River from Wilmington. And Fort Fisher was one of the last coastal forts for the Confederacy. That Wilmington was back then a significant shipping location for the Confederacy. And Fort Fisher did have a coordinated naval force landing at the fort at the same time that there were some ground forces marching down the river to link up with them. It started out very similar to what you were describing, Ian. There were a lot of gunboats and smaller bombarding vessels attacking the fort, but at a certain point they'd pretty much done all the damage they could do, and they still had to put guys on the ground. So there were probably about, you know, between 500 and 1,000 troops landed directly out of the boats just outside Fort Fisher. How opposed you could necessarily get from Fort Fisher is difficult, right? The coastal artillery, there's a certain limit to how far down they can aim their guns to shoot guys on the ground. And so if you can get below their declination and stay outside of musket range, you can land fairly unopposed at that point. You know, when discussing amphibious warfare, we shouldn't get away from the World War II cinematic model of storming the beaches and think more about naval envelopment, you know, sort of transportation over water, more than whether or not the landing was opposed or not. Mo, what do you think?
Yeah, that opens up a lot more history at that point. Because like Ian was saying, really, when it came to naval engagements at that time, if they were not engaging directly in other fleets or ships on the sea, they were kind of against a fort, and the whole point at that point was you have to bombard the fort, you have to stop the fort, because that was the great defense up the rivers and things like that were the forts. If they could keep the ships at bay, then they would not be able to move up inland and get troops, like you were talking about, enveloping them by getting troops up river and putting them on a shore. The thing there is, it really comes down to simple, you know, okay, it's just gonna, who bombards who, you know, who depletes who by bombarding them in the most. But if you can get past that, or even if you can slip past the forts, then you can quietly get troops up to the further up the river. I think then it opens up a lot more interesting aspects. Historically, I don't know anything off the top of my head that I can add in here as far as that goes, because when it comes to ancient warfare, I'm really not, that's not my jam. So I really couldn't say anything other than what I've seen on movies.
Yeah. Yeah, once the tanks disappear from the game, I tend to, I don't want to say I lose interest, but it takes a lot more to pique my interest. So I'm with you. You know, I'm sort of racking my brain here, but it's not an area of expertise for me. And so that is an area that I'd be legitimately concerned with. I'm curious whether or not you guys would consider charging over frozen water to be an amphibious assault. What do you think, Ian?
I'm going to say no. And then I'm going to back up your question and go to the previous one.
Okay.
Harold Buchanan in his 1777 game actually has a good element of amphibious in there, in that the British, as they're moving around, have to pick a destination. And you don't know where it's going to be. And that really captures that, the mobility piece that the British had in the American War of Independence. They had the fleet that could get them to go around. They didn't have to march over land like George Washington. And you have to sit there and look at it, where could they be coming ashore? Where's Howe going to land his army? How do I defend all this when I don't have enough? Which is, back then, that was really what in the American War of Independence, that's what amphibious operations could do, is it gave fits for the Americans and gave some strategic mobility for the British. Charging
you're
over
talking
frozen
about the
ice.
Campaigns of 1777 game.
Campaigns of 77.
The one from S&T.
Correct.
Okay. Just making nice sure he's more famous for liberty or death for the coin game. So I just want to make sure that anybody who's going to go chasing down Harold's design, that they go grab the right thing that they're looking for. Campaigns of 1777 from S&T magazine. What S&T number was it? 316. That's what it was. All
a couple
right.
years back.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's sorry, I didn't mean to cut into you there.
That's a good use of amphibious before amphibious was World War II. It captures the elements in there, and it makes it a nice little element of the whole game for the cat and mouse piece.
Yeah. Yeah. In Liberty or Death, it's a much higher scale across the whole war. So there is some strategic level mobility that the Brits get to avail themselves of. But I think that operational level that you're describing, that certainly is a key point that would keep your colonial opponent on their toes across those campaigns. So the reason I was asking about the whether or not you'd consider crossing the ice to be an amphibious attack is there was the capture of the Dutch fleet that where the French mounted regiment was able to cross a frozen harbor on horseback and storm the Dutch fleet that was frozen into the port. Where was it? Was at Noidiep, so near the town of Den Helder. I remembered the action happening. I couldn't remember the exact name of it. I had to look it up here real quick. But it was the French, if you want to consider that an amphibious assault, the French captured a Dutch fleet with on, you know, while they were on horseback, which I think is a pretty nifty trick if you can do it. But again, not 100% sure that counts as amphibious.
No, it doesn't.
Mo, you're the tie-breaking vote here. Are we going to give the French credit for an amphibious attack on horseback?
Nah. I mean, come on, man. Amphibious on horseback? Did you just hear yourself? If there's ice skating involved or just pushing sleds or riding horses across, I don't think that's amphibious because amphibious, really, the definition is coming from the sea or coming from a body of water. So in not frozen water either. It has to be liquid. Hey. No, not it has to be moving.
It's
so
water.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just moving really, 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 really slow.
Yeah, it's another state of water. I was trying to find us some non-World War II examples of amphibious warfare, just to see what we could come up with. A related question. So this is not direct amphibious warfare, but it's no worse than a second cousin amphibious warfare. Where and how would we connect sort of riverine warfare to true amphibious, you know, wading ashore in an opposed fashion kind of combat? Because in the riverine warfare, you're bouncing between boats and you know, getting boots wet versus getting boots dirty. You're bouncing back and forth quite a bit. I mean, the Navy had a lot of guys getting boots dirty in Vietnam on the southern end of the country where they were fighting a lot of those river campaigns, the swift boats and other, you know, other operations down in the Mekong Delta. S&T had a good magazine about it, a good game about it years ago. It was the Sea Lords of the Mekong Delta, I think was the name. But you find river campaigns throughout history, that Grant's March down the Mississippi, that, you know, when they took down Vicksburg as an example. Would we consider those to be amphibious campaigns, or is that not quite fully all the way there? Understanding there's some fuzzy gray area in between here. Mo, what do you think?
Smaller scale, I would say that's amphibious operations more so than amphibious landings, you know, because if you got a riverboat, one of the brown water Navy guys bringing up a SEAL team, and they're going to just go in there for a parakeet op, or they're going to go in there, gather some intel, or just strike a target, they're going to be in and out. It's going to be a quick strike. They're not going to be, you can't say that they're not going to be opposed. It's not landing in force, not trying to take an objective, not trying to hold an objective, not trying to gain a foothold to have a follow-on force push further in. It's literally hitting targets of opportunity or high value targets, things like that. So it's a different aspect of amphibious operation, of amphibious warfare, but it is more operational than it is an actual, you know, assault that we've been talking about historically.
Yeah. Yeah. Ian, what do you think?
I gotta agree. Closest you may get is like some opposed river crossings. Again, like the some of the large events in World War II, The trying to throw a large force across a river has many similarities to an amphibious operation. I guess by definition, you could say it's crossing water. So yes, it is. It's close enough to me that I don't mind wargaming up together.
Yeah, yeah. There's the famous scene from A Bridge Too Far where they're taking the boats across the river in Holland in the daylight. To try and catch the bridge from the other side where Robert Redford's praying his whole way across. I don't, is that amphibious? I mean, you're coming out of the water onto the dirt on the other side, but you've got ground forces on both sides of that body of water. That may be a stretch, but on the flip side, are we really going to go to war over the definitional details here? Is that something we necessarily need to worry about when we're just looking for fun games to play that have certain aspects to them? So
I'll say no. It's all together.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the questions in terms of those riverine campaigns, depending on how high in scale you go, and when you're looking at some of that Brownwater Navy stuff that Mo was just referring to, where you've got guys on board the boats whose job it is to disembark and fight on the ground, I think that's pretty clearly a lower level, but clearly amphibious operation. I don't recall in the Vicksburg campaign how much, if at all, were the Union troops being transported by boat versus the boats being there kind of as floating artillery for them, maybe helping their logistics train, but the troops actually moving over land in parallel with what was on the river. American Civil War is outside of my normal area of interest. Do either of you recall much about how that campaign unfolded?
I do not. ACW is not one of my strong points either, but just a side note here. What about the crossing of the Delaware?
That's a great call. I didn't even thought of that one until just now.
Yeah, that reminded me. I was like, the one we haven't talked about is kind of a big one.
It's one of the more famous paintings in American history.
So. Yeah, people are still looking for that quarter too.
Yeah, no kidding. It's the great meme of Washington turning around, go, whoever's humming the Jaws theme, cut it out.
True.
It's a great meme there. But again, not an opposed landing at the other side, but certainly an important nautical envelopment of the opponent. They weren't expecting the Americans crossing the Delaware and thought they had their flank protected by the river. And again, that whole thing about, Americans willing to cross a frozen river on Christmas Eve to attack you, no kidding. We've done it. I could certainly see that as an amphibious operation, even though many people probably don't think of it as such. And I think in the wargaming world, if the landing is unopposed, we're not going to bother to play the game out of let's load the dudes in the boats and float them across the river and then disembark at the, we just start with them across the river and say, all right, we'll fight,
Or you may say, okay, let's roll a couple of dice and see how many guys made it across the river. We'll abstract it out, and then you go from there.
Yeah, yeah.
Main thing is it has to be fun.
as fun as you can make it.
True.
I don't recall. There wasn't any sort of floating artillery as a part of that campaign at all. I don't ever recall hearing anything about that in any way, shape, or form.
No, there wasn't.
No.
Yeah.
There wasn't.
Yeah, so... again, when you've got muskets and horses, you're a little outside of my normal sphere of expertise. Once tanks show up, I pay more attention. I will say the Gallipoli campaign from World War One. There's the old adage of Gallipoli was the greatest Allied internment camp of World War One because they pinned down a couple hundred thousand Brits and Commonwealth forces. They knew right where they were. They weren't going anywhere. I don't know how much fun that is. The thing is, I don't know how many Gallipoli games I've ever seen where you've actually got to fight the landing versus once you're already ashore and you're trying to fight your way up the peninsula. Do the games include having to land and fight your way up the hill? I just don't recall.
I think there's some out there that do it, but again, it's not the same as the same intensity has a World War II island hopping campaign.
Absolutely.
Many times Gallipoli games will either focus on sort of the naval approaches or once the troops are ashore trying to get the breakout, but that actual initial landing, which from my memory recollection was opposed but not, was like there was a huge clash of forces there. All the big battles came later after the forces were trying to break out of the beachheads and such.
Yeah. Yeah. That's everything that I've ever seen on Gallipoli.
You know, there's one other amphibious campaign we have not talked about.
I'm sure there's a, you know, a few.
No. That's really famous. And okay. It's also Amphibious Reverse, Dunkirk.
Yeah.
The Extraction and Amphibious Extraction, which is one of the most dramatic in history, you know, and that one's tough to game too, but there have been some games on it. And it's just that, I mean, there's even, they made the movie and all that stuff too. But when you think about amphibious operations, when it comes to the logistical side, like Ian was talking about earlier from the naval side, think about what was put together so fast by the British, by getting that fleet of anything that could float and bringing it over there to save their boys, is an amazing feat. It really is.
Yeah. And then they did it again a couple of years later on a smaller scale at Dieppe, with the famous raid at Dieppe, where they put them ashore and then immediately had to pull them right back out. So they got their boots wet in both directions in that one. I always thought Dunkirk would have made a decent States of Siege game.
Yeah.
Just with the approach of the Germans there. That's one of those ones that always struck me as sort of tough for how do you actually make an entertaining game out of it. And really, States of Siege type system was the best I could come up with. That was really all.
The only thing about a States of Siege game, though, is the high luck interaction in that game. It would be tough, because then you'd feel like, oh, wow, I'm just getting beat by the system, because the system is really heavily weighted against you. So that's tough. Now, there is the one, I can't remember off the top of my head, but Herman Luttman has one that he already has out, and he's coming out with a newer version of it, which is similar, kind of a States of Siege type of feel to it, but it's the extracting the troops to the beach and then getting them off the beach. Can't remember the title off the top of my head.
You're not talking about the one with the Rangers at Pointe du Hoc, are you?
No. That's okay. Crowbar. The other one, I can't think of the name of it. I'll have to see if I can look it up.
Yeah. Yeah, if only you had a space age device capable of instantly producing all sorts of information right there at your fingertips. I had said, you know, we were going to circle back around to it a little bit in terms of World War II, where we're talking full amphibious campaigns, not just individual battles, and the idea of the World War II island hopping campaign, where obviously the Marines kind of had the more famous look. The Marines have always had far better PR people than any other military force in history, but the Marines island hopping campaign that moved again roughly east to west across the Pacific, headed towards Japan. But we know all of the beaches, right? You know, Taro was one of them, Iwo Jima was one of them, where they I'm going to mispronounce it, Mo, but is it Pilo?
Peleliu.
Peleliu. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I told you I was going to mispronounce it. Yeah, I can use the German names. It's the Pacific Island names that I completely screw up.
Miracle at Dunkirk is the game.
Okay.
And that's Legion is doing that one.
Okay.
Herman's got that, covers the extraction from Dunkirk.
Okay, good. Good. Glad to see Herman getting some more games out there. There was that island hopping campaign again, where you described, you know, the Marines were taking islands that, you know, were smaller than most college campuses and some high school campuses, that, you know, they were grabbing these small islands almost to serve as logistics bases for the next foray forward as they were hopping across. Whereas the U.S. Army was coming more out of Australia, hitting some of the bigger islands, working their way up back towards the Philippines, right? MacArthur wanted to retake the Philippines. But you had parallel island hopping campaigns with a variety of amphibious attacks along the way. And so if you wanted to look at amphibious operations, going back to sort of what Ian was talking about back at the beginning of the podcast, that higher level view, you know, World War II is obviously where you're going to find the bulk of it, but you've got a couple of different options out there in the Pacific theater. Ian, thoughts on those two different, to say parallel campaigns implies they were both going the same direction. They ran perpendicular to each other, but at simultaneous campaigns, I guess the way to phrase that, huh?
So I think the one battle campaign to look at is maybe the one that never happened, but it was the culmination of all that, and that is Olympic and Coronet. There's some games out there on it, but that was going to be the big one, where the Marines and the Army came together, and that was going to be, that no longer was just your little island, that was D-Day, Normandy, D-Day in the Pacific. To model that one right, you probably have to come up in scale. Maybe, I don't think you can get away, well, probably divisions. I think that's the way most games go, because what starts off as your amphibious invasion game quickly becomes your like conquest of Kyushu or defense of Kyushu games, or goes into the plains up by Tokyo. But you have to kick it up a level. But all those start off with the amphibious invasion.
Yeah. Yeah. That was
the other thing to keep in mind too is, you know, we talked a lot about the Marines, but we're forgetting the Army, you know, Salerno and Sicily, things like that, that were that do tend to get overlooked. You know, they do tend to get overlooked, especially because that theater does get a lot, get overlooked by quite a bit of gamers. You know, everything is ETO for the most part. I should say East Front for the most part, or the West Front. And that's it. Everyone forgets about, like, and North Africa does get, you know, people do pay attention to that, but the Italian area gets overlooked a lot, you know, and that, and there was some really terrible battles there as well. And there were amphibious assaults there too.
Yeah. It was Sicily, Salerno, and Anzio were the three big ones.
Yeah. Yeah. And it wasn't just, as a matter of fact, I think, was it Sicily? Was the one that was Operation Mincemeat. They just came out with a trailer for Operation Mincemeat, which looks fantastic. So that they're going to go into the whole lead up to the operation when they faked out the Germans by putting a corpse on shore with, you know, bad intel in it to try to fake out the Germans. So I was like, it looks like a real interesting movie.
They were trying to get the Germans, convincing the Germans that they were looking towards the Balkans, like the Adriatic, what was it, the Aegean. They wanted to pull them off the other way. They wanted to freeze some of those German forces on the other side, not allow them, not prevent them from being moved in as reinforcement.
Okay. Yeah. One of the things that ramps up the complexity level a little bit in the European theater, the European theater amphibious operations, is you weren't just coordinating air and naval and your ground forces landing, but in the cases of both Sicily and Normandy, you also had airborne troops going in ahead of things as well behind enemy lines. Mm-hmm. And so you had those guys happening as well. And that adds, you know, again, as you're gaming these things, that's yet another layer of complexity that you now get to pile on. And I think one of the challenges that you run into from a game perspective with that, you see a little bit of it in the Longest Day movie. If you read the book or other contemporaneous accounts of what was going on, the airborne assaults really created a lot of confusion for the Germans as to what the heck was going on at the time that would have helped in creating command confusion on their ability to react to whatever information was coming in, not knowing what was accurate, what was inaccurate, getting any kind of accurate situational awareness in bad weather, in the dark, which reports are good, which reports are bad. The challenge you run into trying to do that in any kind of game is when I see an airborne unit land on the map in a war game, I'm pretty confident there's an airborne unit in that location because I just watched him go onto the map. And that level of command confusion has to be created in some other fashion within the game. That also happened in Sicily, those airborne units landing and some of the havoc they were able to wreck behind German lines in advance of the amphibious landing did make a difference on the beaches there. And that's not something that's necessarily easy to recreate in a war game, because once the guy goes on the map, I kind of know he's there. So.
Yeah, unless it's facilitated. If you have an umpire, then you can do that. But because of perfect information that we have, like you said, you'd have to, you know, model that in some other way.
Yeah. Yeah. Once you're once you go double blind, obviously we're talking a completely different game at that point.
Yeah.
So I was just looking at some of the maps from the Pacific Theater again, because that's where more of those amphibious things happened. But Mo, you're right. There definitely were a bunch of them in the European theater, in the North African theater. You know, when the Allies initially hit Morocco, it's not like they rolled in, you know, rolled right up to the docks and unloaded onto a bunch of docks and wharves. They they had to wade ashore at parts. Mm-hmm. Just for the very start of the war, they had to wade ashore. You know, the French couldn't wait to surrender, but hey, they're French.
And then, of course, Sea Lion.
Yeah.
If that had ever happened.
Yep. Yep. I think there's a lot of what ifs that make for some pretty interesting discussions around amphibious ops. We already mentioned Olympic and Coronet. Sea Lion would be another one. You wonder how serious, if at all, the Allies ever were about trying to do anything about Norway, because people forget Norway was the one country that Germany held on to until the end of the war. Was there ever any stomach for trying to take back Norway, or were they just going to leave it alone? Just, all right, whatever. Be Norwegian. We don't care. know, is that something that was really going to matter? I don't know how much amphibious action there was in the Scheldt campaign in 44, 45. I don't recall much. Brian Train will probably write me an email correcting all of my misstatements, which is fine. Like, Brian knows that campaign and has designed games on it, and he's the expert. He should know.
Which is exactly Brian's point, because the Shelt campaign was in many ways Amphibious and River Crossing combined.
Yeah.
They were going up through the estuaries there, and a lot of what they had to do was some Amphibious and some River Crossing, and that's what makes that campaign so unique.
Yeah.
And it's waterborne ops at that point, rather than just saying Amphibious, because you're doing a mix of both, which, that's a whole different, ball game when you think about coordinating amphibious landings and then your riverine operations. That's totally a different animal.
Yeah. Thinking about some of the other amphibious campaigns, just rattling off a few we hadn't really mentioned, there actually is a fairly obscure one for World War II that Compass did a decent game on some years ago, and that was War in the Wind, which was the Battle of Attu, one of the islands in the Alaskan archipelago, way up there, where the Japanese had occupied it in mid-42, I think it was. And then in mid-43, the Americans decided they were going to go take it back and grossly underestimated the amount of resistance they were going to find there. And,
well, also, the island itself was just a nightmare to fight on.
Yeah, it's a son of a bitch.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter that it's May. It's Alaska, right? Once the sun goes down, it gets cold.
So, very true.
Yeah, that's not going to be a lot of fun. But the Japanese kind of moved in relatively unopposed. There wasn't a whole lot of campaign of the Japanese having to take the island, but the Americans taking it back was quite a fight. And again, that's one of those sort of off-the-wall campaigns that you don't hear about much, but was a legit battle. In terms of those amphibious campaigns, I'm wondering if there's much else in the hypothetical realm within World War II besides Sea Lion and Olympic that we could think of that would have been out there, that would have made a worthwhile game. Was there ever a legitimate threat of an Allied invasion somewhere in the Balkans that would have turned into some sort of opposed amphibious landing somewhere that would have been worth discussing? Crete, Malta, somewhere in Greece, anything out there that would have made for any sort of interesting campaign, do you think?
Operation Mercury did happen, but that was not the Allies. But I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I don't know. Ian is the naval intelligence guy. He'll know that way better than I do. Throwing you under the bus, man.
Yeah, if I can only hit the mic button. I think some people look at like Crete and Malta and they always think about the airborne side of it, of course, because of Mercury. Nobody really looks at the amphibious side. There was amphibious elements there. I mean, as the British were trying to withdraw off of Crete, there was always the worry that there was going to be something at Malta. But there was some amphibious stuff talked about in the Adriatic. Of course, that's where Mincemeat trying to fake the Germans out to tell them to convince them that there was the British were going to be landing somewhere over on that side. I don't think a lot of people have explored it. I think it's how much of a fun game? That's what the question would be. How much of a fun game can you make out of that? Can you find the right scenario pieces? Similarly, like Brian Train probably can do it.
Yeah.
He'll find the right elements.
Thinking back to some hypotheticals over in the Pacific theater, I'm curious if there were any legitimate, proposed amphibious ops, not out on the islands in the Pacific, but more along the mainland, either French Indochina, China itself, Korea. Was there ever much of a proposed Allied amphibious assault of Singapore to try and take it back, as opposed to trying to fight back from land, which is kind of how the Japanese took it in the first place? Obviously, there's not any sort of amphibious operations over in Burma, but I'm wondering elsewhere.
But there were. The initial Japanese invasions.
Mm-hmm.
Came up that way.
That's true.
So I was thinking it's one of those theaters that get. I think the British had some plans. There's a book out there called Graveyard of a Dozen Schemes that talks all about British planning in India and in Burma. And they had a lot of grandiose plans, but nothing ever happened to it. Could it be interesting? Yeah, I mean, you always have the interesting counterfactuals of like a Japanese invasion of Ceylon or something like that, and see how it goes, or even Japanese landing.
I was going to say there is one that just popped into my head, more modern time, which is in a smaller game. Speaking of Brian Train, was Brief Border Wars, the Turkish invasion of Cyprus in 1974. That was one of the four games that is in that in that game where you can move your, you know, your landing spot around the board. And it was it was abstracted, obviously, but that was another part where the amphibious assaults do take place in a, you know, it's a smaller, shorter game, but that is another more modern one that did come in. I know it's completely outside of what we're just talking about. We're talking about World War II.
Yeah.
But it just popped into my head.
No, it's, you know, not bad bringing it up there. Going back to the World War II piece in terms of some of those hypotheticals, I wonder if there was ever sufficient amount of tonnage available for the Russians to even remotely consider their own amphibious invasion of any of the Japanese islands, if the Russians would have ever considered trying to land on Hokkaido or grab any of those Japanese islands in the hopes of retaining them after the war was over. That might have made for a fairly interesting counterfactual, even if it wasn't the most realistic thing out there.
Didn't the Soviets grab a couple of the islands, and that's still what's part of the contention is even today?
There is one or two islands that they're still fighting, but those, I think those were less concerted amphibious invasions than, hey, hurry up and put five guys on that chunk of rock over there so we can claim it. Because I don't think there was a whole lot of there wasn't a whole lot of opposition on the ground to those landings. That doesn't mean there's not still political wrangling over them today, absolutely. But I don't know that it was some sort of concerted land invasion the way we're conceptualizing a lot of the other amphibious ops we've talked about tonight. Oh. You know, the primary Russian thrust at the end of the war that was their attempt at a land grab was trying to get into Manchuria right at the end of the war. But yeah, they did grab what was then a Japanese island or two that they're still fighting over, metaphorically.
Now, there is one other one that is a kind of a humorous aside that I remember. I don't know all the details about, but it's something in the Arctic where I think it's Han Island or something like that. The Danes and the Canadians,
yeah,
where they keep fight over it every
trading year. Bottles of scotch or something.
Yes, they leave a bottle of whiskey for the other side. I think that's kind of neat. You know, it's like, hey, if you're gonna have a fight, that's a good way to have a fight. You know, it's like I come up there, I take your bottle, and I leave a bottle for you. So yeah. I think that's kind of a neat little, often overlooked, definitely overlooked. Little it's more of a I think it's more fun than it is anything else. Yeah, it's definitely an interesting subject, but also at the same time it shows you, because the difficulty we're having talking about it, how tough it is. And when it comes to Japan at the end of the war, it was also a great driver. Okinawa was the biggest decider, I think, for when it comes to, are we going to invade the homeland? If we're going to go after the mainland of Japan, it would just been way worse than Okinawa was. And Okinawa was brutal.
Yeah.
So that's where the decision was made to use atomic weapons to end the war before anything else was, you know, worse things happened on the mainland.
Yeah. Probably need to go ahead and wrap this up, because for those of us on the East Coast, it's closer to bedtime than it is for Mo. So, Mo, wrap up thoughts on amphibious warfare here. What do you think?
I think it's one of the more difficult aspects to get right in a game and make it engaging. I think what designers are doing now is pretty much spot on as to where it needs to be or where it can be. Maybe there's other ideas out there that can kind of extrapolate some of the other aspects of it and put it in there in a fast fashion and an enjoyable fashion to, you know, entertain people. But really it comes down to just getting your troops on the, you know, on the landing craft and bringing them in, and then just dealing with the opposition on the beach to gain that foothold there. As far as adding in the aspect of the naval, the big ships on the outside, it's tougher, especially anything modern would be real tougher because of over the horizon capabilities for everybody. But still, it would be interesting to see how many more ideas are out there.
Yeah. Ian, we're gonna let you have the last word on this one. Amphibious ops and wargaming overall.
Amphibious ops and wargaming is hard. I think Mo hit a lot of the big points. It's finding it, the tactical may be the most enjoyable. There's also a lot to be said about extracting out a lot of pieces and going up further and making amphibious ops part of like your victory conditions, you know, getting your pieces to the right places and making that work. But for the most enjoyment, it's going to be tactical, and it's going to be down at that individual islands. And of course, the theme that people are going to connect to the most is going to be the World War II island hopping in the Pacific. So I think that's where we're going to be, and then we're going to be there for a while. It's going to be where the games go.
Yeah. I think if nothing else, we as we've wandered our way through this conversation, I think the idea of what people can conceptualize as an amphibious operation might be wider than we all initially approached this recording thinking up front. And so I think there's probably more options available if you're willing to look a little further afield beyond just heroic figures charging up a beach under gunfire. There's a little more you could do with amphibious warfare than just that. And I think we sort of stumbled into that point along the way here. But nonetheless, I hope folks have taken some inspiration out of this discussion. And I thank you, gentlemen, for having a great discussion here this evening. And that we, you know, look, worst case, we help some publishers sell some war games. That's kind of, you know, cool whenever we can help people do that, that folks go out and pick up some war games on Amphibious Ops and, you know, pop in our forums and let us know what you think, what's going on with your amphibious wargaming and what kinds of inspirations you've drawn from some of those, what kinds of new approaches you might have taken to wargaming as a whole, but amphibious wargaming in particular, based on some of the discussions we've had here tonight. Be interested to know, if we kick over any new rocks in people's thought processes to attack games in a slightly different way. Because sometimes that's what we hope for here. So Mo, thank you very much. Appreciate you popping in for your first appearance this season. Hope you get a chance to come back sometime. What we really need to know is, are you going to join us at Origins next summer?
That remains to be seen. I'm not sure what's going to happen next summer. I don't think anybody knows what's going to happen next summer, but is it going to be back in June now?
That's the plan. We are planning on a June Origins. And it was kind of funny because at this past Origins, everybody was saying, well, you know, we got a year to get ready. No, we don't. We don't have a year to get ready for next summer. We're already 4 months behind.
it's just we got hockey starting up in another, 11 days, and we just ended in like June.
Yeah. we got hockey starting here in two.
Yeah. It's just crazy.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Ian, thank you for joining us. Absolutely going to have you back later this season because we've got a couple of events coming up later this season that we're going to bring you on to rant and rave and yell about. So,
awesome. That thank said, you very much.
You going to be able to join us for Origins next summer?
That's the harder one.
Yeah. It's driving distance for you. It's a bit of a haul.
Yeah, but it's not a family. It clashes with a lot of other family issues. I got a boy that's going to go to college next year and everything. So, yeah.
Yeah, there is that. I had that odd, because again, October Origins, right? Completely screws everybody's schedule up. As I was driving up there this year, I sent my son a message like, it's weird going to Origins without you in the car because he's been with me for pretty much all of them. You know, when we lived there and then when we've traveled up there to go to them, he's been along. He worked a couple of them, you know, working as a booth minion for David over at Lock and Load. So it was weird going to Origins without him in the car. But cool. Guys, thanks. Been a lot of fun. Audience, thanks. Hope you enjoyed it. We will catch you next time on another episode of Mentioning Dispatches.